welcome to this, our fifth Parliamentary Library Lecture. We started this series called the Parliamentary Library Lecture last year when we had identified some speakers that we had topics that were really important for us to get a, sort of a whole 1 hour presentation and question and answer time for, rather than the vital issues seminars where we've generally had two different perspectives given. And we've been very fortunate to have some absolutely tremendous speakers, and today we're fortunate to have another tremendous speaker. Our speaker today is Robert Stimson from the University of Queensland, who's going to be speaking to us about a really major ARC funded project, the Research Network in Spatially Integrated Social Science, and particularly the electric Geography of Australia. Professor Stimson is a graduate of the University of New England and holds his doctorate from Flinders University. He's Professor of Geographical Sciences and Planning at the University of Queensland and a Program Director for the UQ Social Research Centre. The ARC-funded project he'll describe to us today was established in 2004 with over 280 members across 18 member universities and the Australian Bureau of Statistics. So no small challenge in organising all those parties to agree to anything, let alone to agree to as detailed a project as this one. He's one of Australia's leading researchers in urban and regional analysis and the study of human spatial behaviour, the author or joint author of 40 books and monographs and around 200 scientific papers. He's a former Fulbright Senior Scholar and recipient of the J.P. Thompson Medal awarded by the Royal Geographical Society of Queensland. We're very fortunate to have Professor Stimson with us today, and I will hand over to him for his presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, particularly to talk to this sort of audience. What I'm going to talk to today is a new national database that we've been putting together, and it's part of a whole series of online databases that the Spatially Integrated Social Science Research Network is developing. My group at the University of Queensland has been doing for some years, and the presentation I'll make today will draw on the work I've done with my colleague, Dr. Paul Shai, who is here with me today, and Dr. Prem Chetra, who is not with us today. What this presentation is about is to talk about an electoral geography of Australia that we've been developing. It discusses how an online geographic information system has been used to enable a display of voting patterns, and the way in which those voting patterns can be matched to socioeconomic and demographic data across Australia at the small area level of the polling booth and the catchments around polling booths. The presentation also will talk about how we can identify through statistical modelling what the demographic and socioeconomic factors are that explain the variations in patterns of levels of electoral support for political parties across Australia at a small area level. And we've developed a model too to predict voting outcomes and tested that at the 2004 federal election. And finally, I'll talk about the way in which we can develop and put political parties and their position in a socio-political space or landscape of Australia, and look at how voting patterns for and support for political parties is differentiated on a number of socio-economic demographic dimensions. We also, through this, are able to identify what are the real voter heartlands of strong support for the major political parties and where the areas of marginality are, and model where they are located and the types of areas that are subject to quite a high likelihood of voting swing at a federal election. So it's a lot of stuff I'm going to cover. I'm going to put up a lot of maps and patterns and so on and talk about some results of the modelling that's come out. And I'll do it in as non-technical a way as I can. At the last federal election, there was a further consolidation, really, in geographic terms of the areas of concentration of support for the coalition parties that represented, over a period of elections, quite an incursion into what was the sort of heartland of areas of support for the Labor parties at past federal elections. The two-party difference was 52.74 to 47.26, and there was in fact almost a 1.8% swing to the coalition at that election. For the first time, of course, in two decades, the coalition, one party, was in control of both the House and the Senate. The dynamics of the patterns of voting, geographic patterns of voting across Australia, have received some attention, but not a great deal of research in Australia, particularly at what we call a spatially disaggregated or a local area level. The orientation is very much on single electorates in terms of the research. What it seems to have emerged is that the so-called aspirational voters that seem to have been going more towards supporting the coalition in recent elections are very much found across the lower and middle income workers of the outer parts of cities, the outer suburbs, middle to outer suburbs of cities. And in fact, over successive elections, the coalition had made significant gains in a local area in terms of voter support there. And it's kind of interesting too that Labor support has become very, very entrenched and stronger in the inner city areas, the latte set areas of the inner cities where singles live, a lot of professionals and so on. And it's kind of interesting, you'll see how stark these geographic patterns are on the maps that I'll be putting up. Outside the metropolitan areas, it's almost all coalition, except in areas of remote parts and where there are large numbers of Indigenous peoples, and in some of the older regional industrial cities and the mining areas. But again, there is a very, very marked, distinct demarcation in the geography of patterns of voting. There's been a really detailed lack of any statistical analysis of the degree of spatial concentration and dispersion in primary votes and the two-party preferred votes in terms of published research in Australia. And most of the work that's done, particularly in the political science area, has focused on voting at the electorate level. We've tried to sort of overcome that, fill that void in this research that we've been doing, in order to improve our understanding of the variations at the local level of voting. And because we've got compulsory voting in Australia, and because most people do vote at their local polling booth, we're able to use the electoral databases and other databases and integrate those using the geographic information systems technologies and do modelling that we just could not have done about 10 years ago. So we've attempted to apply quite sophisticated statistical and spatial analytic techniques and modelling and visualisation to try and develop a better understanding of what the patterns of voting are across the cities and regions of Australia and what the demographic and socioeconomic factors might be that can explain a fairly large degree of the variability in those patterns. So the databases we use are from, I'll be talking today about the last election, the 2004 election. We've done analyses of previous elections and we'll be doing so of the one later this year as well. We get the voting data from the Electoral Commission, Australian Electoral Commission, and today I'm going to show how we interface all of that data with information that can be derived from the National Census. And we're going to focus on those polling booths, and there are over 7,500 of them across Australia. We've geocoded all of those, and then we've created a new electoral geography of catchment areas and reorganised all the census data into catchment areas around, voter catchment areas around local polling booths across Australia. So if you like, you can think of, we've got a huge database of over 7,500 points where people vote, and we've got how they voted for political parties, and over that, we overlay on that the characteristics from the census of the populations that live in those catchments of local polling booths. And that enables us to use a whole lot of quite sophisticated tools and techniques of analysis to model and test a whole lot of hypotheses and so on. So the sort of data, we have 46 or 47 of variables here that relate to the age and sex, the family household structure, the housing tenure, ethnic race characteristics of local populations, religious affiliations of people, the degree of in and out movement, the residential mobility of local areas, the digital divide, the degree to which households are connected to the internet, those sorts of things, the nature of engagement in work, in industries and occupations, levels of human capital, education, skills, those things, and income. Right, now, the routines that we use here, you can interrogate online these databases. And we can display patterns of voting through a whole series of different sorts of techniques. And we can zoom in and zoom out, go right down to the local polling booth area. We can overlay names of electorates, of polling booths. We can put road systems onto the databases. So there's a whole series, a menu of things you can select from online to do overlay with the patterns of voting at the polling booth level, and superimpose then information from the census that's been reorganised in our analyses and is now available online. All the census data is reorganised for these polling booth catchments, the 7,580 of them, or whatever it is. Okay, so you get this sort of a map. Here is the two-party preferred vote for the coalition. And you can represent this in all sorts of different ways. This is called showing it by natural breaks in the levels of voting. And in fact, you've got some polling booths where you've got 100% of people voting for the coalition and the two-party preferred. And you've got some where there were zero. And then you can see the distribution there. That's one way of doing it. And you can do it another way, and that is to benchmark that data. We know how the nation voted for the political parties, and 52.74% of votes across Australia in the two-party preferred went to the coalition. So what we can do is give you an alternative too and say, okay, at the local area, at the polling booths in my electorate, for example, at each polling booth, how is the voting in percentage terms above or below that national benchmark? And that's done by what we call, it's a simple index called the location quotient, and I won't go into it. But what it does, it tells you the proportion of voting and how much in percentage terms it was above or below the national benchmark. So here, where we're using location quotients, where it's in the blue here, that's above average level of support relative to the national level of support for a political party, and the red say the magnitude of below average level of support. Now, that when you look at the map of Australia here, you've got, it's very difficult to sort of sort that out, what's going on there. So you want to be able to hone in local areas. And here's the pattern for the ALP, for example. If we look at it here in terms of where the blue ones here across Australia, you can see that right across a lot of remote areas, mining communities and so on, there is above average support in the two-party preferred for the Labor Party at the last election. But right across all the rural heartlands, it's red, the pattern here, below average support. So if we start to drill down and we look at things within Sydney, for example, here is the pattern for the coalition party. The blue dots, these are the voting booths, polling booths, where there was above average support and the magnitude of it. So you can see there are some booths there where there's more than 50% of voting support above the national average for the coalition, which means that just about everyone in those polling booths is supporting the coalition. And then you can see there's a very distinct geographic pattern here, isn't there? And then if we look at it for Labor, here the blue is where there's above average support for Labor and the red below average support. It's the mirror image. And one of the things, and when we start to put the electoral boundaries over it, one of the things that we've found very fascinating here is that for a lot of electorates, you've got a domination across pretty much all of the polling booths in terms of level of support for one party or the other. But there are relatively few electorates across Australia where you've got a great mix going on. And of course, they're the areas of great marginality. And later on, I'll show you some slides where we can actually go in and locate on the ground where those marginal areas of high marginality are. So just skipping across the cities, Melbourne, this is the pattern for the coalition. Again, remember here, blue is above average, and the darker the blue, the greater above average it is of support for the coalition and the primary vote in this case, and the red is the greater below average concentration. So again, what we find when we go across the capital cities of Australia, there's a very distinct geography here. And if we look at the pattern for the Labor Party in Melbourne, here it is. If we go to Brisbane, less of a distinct pattern here because of Brisbane's a somewhat a different place, and it's physically much more diverse than Sydney and Melbourne. But there is still a relatively marked pattern coming through, and particularly for the Labor vote, a lot of above average out in the Western Corridor, in the inner city areas and so on. You go into Adelaide, it almost divides between the north and the outer south, of low support for the coalition and high support for Labor, whereas the middle and the eastern and the seaside areas is where the coalition support is and the Labor support is relatively low. So, and just to skip over to Perth, here is the pattern here again, a relatively distinct geography sort of coming through. Now, we can also move on to look at for the minor parties. Where is the vote for the Green Party occurring? Well, when you look at the pattern for Australia, and this is taking natural breaks, there were some polling booths in Australia where the primary vote for the Greens was as high as 50.64%. And there are lots and lots of ones where it was down as almost negligible or negligible. What's that pattern look like when we sort of hone in? Well, let's have a look at Sydney, for example. And here is that location quotient for Sydney. Areas where there's above average support for the Green Party, you can see it's very much concentrated in the middle and some of the coastal areas of Sydney. When we look at the Democrats, their vote very much collapsed largely at the last election, particularly their primary vote in the House of Representatives. But you can see where there is a higher level of support, and it gets as high as 22.5% in some booths. You can see that that's located mainly in the Northern Territory and South Australia, and not much elsewhere. If you look at for the first time, we had the Family First, and again, there's the areas where there is higher than average concentration. There is very much in Queensland, Victoria, and South Australia. And if you sort of hone into the cities, and you can do this online with the system, you'll find there are some very, very interesting patterns. And you can hone right down to inside your electorate and all the polling booths and the catchments within them. Well, we can start to overlay socioeconomic and demographic patterns here. Now, let's go in to Melbourne. here is, we're honing into the Melbourne metropolitan area, and the Melbourne metropolitan area here is defined by that green line, and and then we've got electoral boundaries, and we've got the polling booth locations, and then polling booth catchments. Now, what we're doing here is saying, okay, we're looking at the classification in terms of natural breaks in the primary vote. Here, this is for coalition, and we're superimposing a variable from the census, which is the top 20%. The concentration of incidence of the top 20% of households on household income. So this is, if you like, the high income, and then we show that there. And you can start to look at the relationships here between socioeconomic demographic phenomena, and we can hone in here, for example, go in more to these the middle and central parts of Melbourne, and then we can start to put the electoral names on, you can put the road systems, you can put the polling booth names on, and so on. You can focus in and focus out online to look at these. And then if you want to as well, you can say, well, now I'd like to look at the pattern in terms of where are the places where there was more coalition voting for the coalition than Labor on the primary vote, and similarly more coalition for voting for the Labor than the coalition on the primary vote, and sort of overlay that, say, with the 40 to 55-year-old group, and that was basically the baby boomer group at the 2001 census. So you can see here that there isn't all that kind of interest in a match, and not as clear a match as you had with the income characteristic, for example. And you can start to hone in now, go down to more into the local area, and you can see that there's sort of there's some relationship here between Liberal and Labor voting, but not much, not nearly as much for this demographic group, this age group, as there was, say, for an income group. So you can sort of do a lot of experimentation around. Now, when you look at all the data, you know, that matrix we had of 7,500 polling booths across Australia, the voting patterns for political parties, and then the characteristics of those areas, those local polling booth areas, the catchments, in terms of the 46 demographic and socioeconomic variables we look, what happens when we start to model there? And we can actually start to generate some political landscapes using GIS technology. For example, here is a generalised map of the electoral geography for the coalition, in terms of the darker the colour, the higher the support, the lower the lighter the colour, the lower the level of support. So this gives us sort of a continuous geographic surface, if you like. And GIS technology can take that polling booth data and generalise it and so on, using GIS technology to get a generalised pattern or landscape. And you can put this across Australia. Here it is for the Liberal Party. And it's interesting, not much in Western Australia and South Australia, the Liberals' vote is higher in country areas than New South Wales, Queensland. And so that's because the national support is lower in those places. And the coalition's made up of both the Liberal and the National. Here's the pattern for the National Party. So you can start to see where the real heartlands are. And we can zoom in and out here, go down to the very, very low. You can go down to the local sort of street level if you want to with this sort of data. So if we look at the Labor Party, when you look at the generalised pattern across Australia as a whole, we see that the Northern Territory, remote parts of Western Australia, in particular mining communities, and then a few of some of the older industrial and mining cities, and you can pick them up when you hone in where the landscape of support is for Labor. It's pretty much devoid across a lot of the rural heartlands, the wheat sheep belts, for example, that are the type of rural heartlands. Very, very low levels of support for Labor in those areas. Let's go in to look at the pattern for the coalition parties in Sydney here, and here we've got the electorate shown. You won't be able to read them that far back, but you can see very, very clear sorts of dominance in parts of Sydney for the coalition, and similarly for Labor. A distinct geography sort of coming through. And similarly, if you look at the pattern for the Greens here, there are very, very distinct areas within the Sydney region of concentrations of high levels of voting for the Greens. And indeed, there where you get that high level of voting for minority parties, then that starts to translate into where those the distribution of preferences for those votes then start to become quite important in terms of electoral outcomes. If you look at the Democrats, and the core of the Democrat support has traditionally been in Adelaide, but at the last election in terms of the primary vote, the core areas were just in actually about three, and not very high, but three, limited to about three areas in terms of support for House of Representative candidates by the Democrats at the last election. And for the family first, again, just taking the example of Brisbane, you can start to see where the real cores are on the ground of voter support for the family first, which stood for its first election. Didn't get a great deal of the vote, but in some electorates it actually did get up as high as 7-8% on a geographic area basis, which could have influences in distributions of preferences, of course. So we can now start to get in and do a lot of statistical analysis of that big data matrix of the voting and the demographic and socioeconomic patterns across the 7,500 plus polling booths in Australia. So one of the things that we can do is use a technique that economists and other social scientists use very, very commonly, and that's what's called, it's called multiple regression analysis. And what it does is it enables us to say, well now, across Australia, across all the places where people vote in Australia, how much of the variability in the patterns of voting for the political parties can be explained by those 46 variables we took from census data. Well, what we show here is that in terms of the variability in the pattern of voting for the coalition parties, we can explain about 54% of that variability by 10 variables. There's still a lot that we're not explaining, and you would expect that, but at least we can start to get a little bit of a handle on what particular socioeconomic demographic characteristics of local populations might be very significant in explaining a lot of the vote for political parties. Well, for the coalition party there were a relatively small number explaining 54%. When we divide the vote into the Liberal and National, we get much less, only around about a third being explained by a relatively small number of variables. For the Labor Party, we can explain 53% of the national variation on the basis of, I think it's 16 socioeconomic demographic characteristics there. For the Greens, we can explain 50% of the variability in their vote on a relatively small number of characteristics of local populations. And similarly for Family First, it's not nearly as clear. We can only account for just under 29% explain it there. So that tells us a little bit more than we know just by looking at patterns of voting and patterns of individual census data variables. The statistical modelling can tell us a little more. It can inform us a little more. But we can go beyond that, in fact. And we can try to develop a model that can predict what local voting patterns, the outcomes will be of voting patterns at the local level in terms of level of support for political parties. Again, we use here a technique, it's a commonly used statistical routine called discriminant analysis. I won't go into it. It's statistically very complicated and very sophisticated, and it's used widely in social science research. So we use again the same 46 census variables, the same 7,500 plus polling booths. What can we get out of this analysis? Well, we can get every polling booth in Australia classified according to where it falls in the level of voting support for political parties into seven groups. And these groups are listed in the table here. There are those polling booths across Australia, and there were about 2,200 of them where the Labor Party dominated in terms of the primary vote, got most of the primary votes. Then for the Liberal Party, there were 3,879 polling booths where where they got most of the primary votes across Australia. The National Party got most of the primary votes in 1,119 polling booths. The Greens, when we got into the you get a problem when you look at the minor parties. And we took the view saying, well, if a local area is demonstrating a lot of support for a minor party, let's just say, in this case, we took where you get 20% or more of the primary vote going to a minor party, that's going to have a big, big influence on outcome. And we could take 10 in order to look at it in a more detailed way. So you can set that in an arbitrary way. You can make it 5% if you wanted to. So when you make it 20%, we see that there are 217 booths across Australia where the Greens were getting more than 20% of the primary vote. Now that demonstrates that they're really areas where Green support's high and it's going to have a fairly profound effect in terms of the outcome, particularly if they're concentrated in particular electorates, then they're going to have very profound influences on the voting outcome in terms of the two-party preferred in those electorates. In terms of the votes in this case, there was only one polling booth across Australia where we could say that there was really a real dominance effect in terms of the Australian Democrats and the Family First. If we drop the threshold from 20 down to 10%, that goes up a bit, but it doesn't go up very much. And our modelling also enables us to say, well, okay, from the model that we run through, we would predict from the modelling, we can identify the number of polling booths, and then we can map them in terms of where they fit in these groups. And we can also, from the analysis we did of the 2001 census, we can say what the number of polling booths that were coming in and out. For example, if you look for the Labor Party there, there were 2,227 polling booths across Australia where there was dominance in terms of primary vote for the Labor Party. And you wouldn't need preferences. Preferences wouldn't sort of count at all in terms of that local area. And that had dropped by 341 polling booths compared to the previous election, which is quite a significant drop. That's over 10% of polling booths. For the Liberal Party, they had gained dominance in more than 458 polling booths between the 2001 and the 2004 election, and the Nationals had in 160 of those polling booths. The Country Liberal Party, they only run candidates in the Northern Territory, so you've got to have that in there because that accounts for everything in the Northern Territory. We can now look at what are the factors that can explain how those polling booths were allocated in demographic and socioeconomic terms, okay? So the discriminant analysis enables us to model through and identify what are some key social and economic and demographic dimensions that underline the distribution of those patterns of voter support for political parties. And in fact, we can explain 96.7% by just three factors. We can generalise it to three factors. And we can in fact, you can look at this in detail. I'm leaving, the library will have this, and you can actually look at some papers we've done that are accessible on our website. This is just showing that, you know, this is the output you get from the statistical analysis. What's it all mean? Well, the first function that's important and accounts for 54.7% of what's called the statistical variance, we can account for 54.7% of the variability across Australia in terms of where polling booths are grouped, in terms of that sevenfold grouping, by factors, by socioeconomic and demographic factors that can be summarised as representing at one end of a dimension areas that were monocultural, that is mainly Australian and British in terms of ethnic groups and so on, and older populations, and at the other end you've got multicultural areas and the mix-up of those with younger people. So that's a dominant dimension that seems to, it accounts for, in fact, 54.7%. Statistically, it accounts for 54.7% of the variability in the pattern of level of voting support for political parties at the polling booth level. The other big dimension, which accounts for 28.9% of this statistical variance, and it's associated with 11 variables that we can put together and say these represent disadvantage to advantage. Low-income households, low-skill jobs, those sorts of things at one end. High-income households, the professionals, high-skill jobs and so on at the other end. So when you take those two very fundamental demographic, socioeconomic dimensions that sort of summarise what socially is going on across Australia, we can see that if you add them together, you've got well over 80% of the variations in patterns of voting explained just by these two dimensions. And that's a fairly interesting sort of finding. And there are 16 variables that load on that are important on that monocultural, older, multicultural, younger dimension. And there are 11 variables that are very important on the disadvantage, advantage dimension. Now, when we put those dimensions and put them orthogonally, we map them on the graph, what do we get? And we distribute the polling booths. We can do that to create what's called a socio-political space across Australia. And here is the pattern you get. Very hard to interpret, isn't it? So you can see this part of the graph down here is dominated more by red, and you then start to get the black and the purple up. That's putting all 7,500 of the polling booths on this graph, okay? And one function is the multicultural the multicultural young dimension. That's function one that runs up and down, and across is the disadvantage advantage one. Okay, what we can now is say, okay, you can't interpret that. So we need to generalise it. Here's what happens when we generalise it. We can put the position, which is the midpoint of support for various political parties, those polling booths that are dominated by the Labor vote are located mainly in this quadrant of the graph under here. And they're associated with local populations characterised by multicultural and younger voters, and by a lot of characteristics of populations that relate to this disadvantage dimension. Okay? When we look at where the National Party is, those polling booths that are dominated, where the voting is dominant for the National Party, that comes up here in this part of the graph, where the characteristics of those local areas are populations that are monocultural, older people, but there's also quite a lot of disadvantage, and that's reflected in terms of fairly low income levels in the farm sector, etc., etc. Okay. Now, then when we look at the Liberal Party, that's, you can see that it's not all that far off the centre. So, and in fact, over time, it's kind of interesting. It's been moving in that direction. That's kind of interesting. What's going to happen in the next election? Well, we're going to be fascinated to find out, of course. And we're going to find out because we're going to do this analysis again. But you can see here that the centre, if you like, this might be regarded as the centre, the average polling booth for all of those polling booths where the dominant vote was for the Liberal Party. Over 50% of the primary vote for the Liberal Party. Okay. Now, you can see that, okay, that's pretty much getting towards the middle here. I mean, it's not really out here on this monocultural older like the midpoint for the average point for the National is. And it's not really up here in terms of advantage. I was fascinated to find where this Greens Party one came out. A lot of it is the local, those polling booths where the Greens are picking up quite a sizable chunk of the primary vote, and there aren't all that many, there's a few hundred of them, but there aren't all that many. The people who live there in those local areas is kind of interesting. They're pretty well off. They've got high incomes. They've got professional jobs and those sorts of things. And they're multicultural and all the younger voters. And then when you look at, we couldn't do it for the Democrats and the Family First, because there aren't enough booths to be able to allocate. So, from this sort of analysis, we can start to get a little bit of a better understanding that we just have not really had in terms of analysing patterns of voting at the local level and trying to look at what the local characteristics of populations are, the vote of those polling booths. We've done it on an electoral basis, but that doesn't tell us nearly as much. And for the first time, with this sort of work, and we're starting to get some quite a good statistical analysis and starting to be able to explain, at least in statistical terms, what important dimensions are that underline the vote that's associated with high levels of support for particular political parties. And this starts to add some explanation to those map patterns that we showed earlier on. So what we can do is then say, okay, now let's look at where in Australia those polling booths are that are solidly ALP, Labor, solidly Liberal and National, and that also have high levels of votes for the Green. Well, here's the pattern for Australia, and of course this doesn't tell you all that much. What it does quite clearly show is that the Nationals have got their support out in country areas. Well, we know that anyhow, okay? And we now know a lot more about the populations associated with that vote from the statistical analysis. We can hone in. Here's the pattern, for example, in Sydney. Now, this is kind of interesting here because it shows that the core of support for the Labor Party is very much an inner city phenomenon and an inner western and then going out to the west and the southwest sectors. It's kind of interesting there when you look at the Greens. It's the centre of Sydney that support the Green Party. Kind of interesting, isn't it? And the same pattern's coming through in the other capital cities. I haven't got the time to show all of them. You can sort of hone in and really go in much further here. Here's the pattern for Melbourne. And again, you can see there are quite distinct geographic areas where the Greens are capturing a significant part of the vote. Their preferences will have probably quite important outcomes. In fact, most of them, the outcomes basically are to then give the Labor Party candidates support in those areas.
Doesn't that map overstate the Green influence, because you're comparing a 50% Green influence with a 50% ALP vote?
Don't forget it's the ones where 20% of polling booths had primary votes for the Greens.
Yeah.
Now it would go, up, if we put it up to 30%, there'd be very few of them, of course, if we put it down to 10. What we're trying to do here is say, we're not saying that they're going to return Green candidates. They're not. But what it's saying is Green candidates are going to have a big influence on the outcome there in those polling booths, okay? Then when you look at the pattern in Brisbane, again, the geography is a little more mixed up. It's quite a lot of marginal seats, actually, in Brisbane. And then Adelaide, quite a distinct geography coming through there. And then Perth again. Now, there's a lot of commonality here. And one of the things that's really striking us, I think, is in geographic terms, particularly the cities and also across regional areas in Australia too, you've got emerging what are vast areas that are dominantly supporting a particular political party. And you've got relatively small areas that are where there's votes, a level of support for minor parties that will have potentially a big influence on outcomes. And you can go online and you can overlay the seat boundaries and look, and you can hone in on a particular House of Representatives electoral division. Okay. Now, from this modelling, overall, we're getting, when we ran the model through and tested what the voting outcomes would be from the model we developed as against the actual outcome, we got it right in 67% of polling booths, which is not too bad for this sort of modelling, because there's still a lot of noise out there. I mean, there's values that people have. It's how, generations might have voted from one to another, and you can't pick up, the whim on the day of the swinging voter and so on. But what we're able, from those census variables that we used, using those, we can account for, we can model through, and we think probably predict an electoral outcome accurately in 67% of the polling booths across Australia. In statistical terms, I can tell you, in the social science research, that's not bad. I mean, it's not great either, because we've still got, 32% of booths where it's going to be very, very difficult in a statistical model to predict the outcome. However, that's the nature of social science research. And this table here, and it's kind of an interesting one to look at here, we looked at what the actual outcome was, how voters voted in polling booths, and then what the model predicted. We got it right in some cases and a little wrong in others, but there is we can see where we were getting it right. One of the things that I found quite interesting is the model actually predicted more booths to support the National Party than they actually got. And that shows that there has, in fact, when you start to look into that, well, it's relatively easy to explain, because there has been quite a lot of incursion in terms of Liberals winning seats in what were once National Heartland, and a number of seats that used to be held by Nationals, in fact, went to Liberals the last couple of elections. So you can start to sort of pick up some of these sorts of nuances in this sort of work as well. Now, the heartlands, what we can do here is now use GIS techniques to actually map in continuous surfaces what are the voting heartlands and what are the marginal areas. And we can do this in variable ways. What we're really wanting to try and do here is say, well, let's look at the areas across Australia that are real core, where it wouldn't matter what level of swing you had, they're always going to support Labor at one end, and at the other end, always going to support the coalition. And you can see here across rural and regional Australia, the country divides pretty starkly, doesn't it? The Reds dominant Labor, probably never going to go any other way, and the Boers dominant coalition, probably never going to go any other way. It would take huge swings, 20%, 15-20% plus, for any change in those areas. Okay. Then the really interesting areas are these green ones, which are highly marginal, and the light pink, which are ones that are Labor but could easily go Liberal if there was a swing to the Liberal, and the real light blue ones are those of the coalition, and that could easily, with a very small swing, go to Labor. Now, when you look across rural regional Australia, and if you look at the areas of green and then the areas around, you can see that in terms of geographic space, there's nowhere that much of the country that's marginal, okay? And we can hone in there and find where those polling booths are located. Let's look at the patterns in the cities, because in my view, the next electorate's going to be won in a few seats in Sydney, Brisbane, Adelaide, and possibly Perth. And our data certainly shows that. There are about 13 seats that are really highly marginal. And they come out in this sort of work. Here's the pattern for Sydney. Now you can see that in a lot of electorates, and when we put the electoral boundaries over it, here's one here, Hughes. I mean, no matter what happens in terms of swings, probably, that's not going to change much, because there's not much geographic space and very little polling booths associated with that geographic space where there's any degree of marginality at all. Okay? Whereas if you go into electorates, I can't read this. If you go into these sorts of prospect and so on, out here, a lot of marginality. You go into MacArthur, oh, there's a lot of marginality, and so on. I mean, there's no marginality in some of these inner city seats like Gwydir and so on. So there's about four or five seats in Sydney there that have quite significant spatial areas and quite a lot of polling booths associated with them that are highly marginal. When you look at Melbourne, again, there's huge swathes of electorates there where it's not going to really matter if there's a swing one way or the other. It's not going to change. However, there are some areas where there's, you know, quite a high degree of potential volatility. If you come out, a lot of Hotham out here has it, in the eastern part of it, for example. Isaacs down here's got quite a deal of volatility, a whole potentially volatility in it. And it's where the green and then the light blue, particularly if it's going to swing from Labor to Liberal at the next election, and that's what a lot of the media and other sort of popular interest is in at the moment. If there were to be a change of government, you know, where are the areas that are going to deliver it? Well, this sort of analysis identifies those very, 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 very readily. That's not going to say it's going to happen at all, but the modelling that we've undertaken can identify those potential areas. If you go into Brisbane, again, you can see many electorates are just dominantly one party or the other, but there are quite a number of electorates in the Brisbane area that really have lots of areas of high marginality. Adelaide, there are electorates like Wakefield that have a high degree of marginality in them. And when you move over to Perth, again, there's areas with high amounts of marginality. If you look at places like Swan and Hasluck and even parts of Fremantle have significant areas of high marginality. So that way you can really identify in geographic terms in continuous space where the real political heartlands are and where the marginality areas are. I want to finish up, so I'm going to skip over a few things here. Okay, let's wrap it up. What we've done here is, in this work, is to show how new spatial information technologies, which weren't there 15 years ago, they're now there and we can do some pretty wonderful things with them. And particularly in terms of interfacing different data sets and then mapping them and generating patterns and interfacing GIS technologies with statistical modelling. I think that this work is fairly unique in Australia. Some of this work's been published in the next issue of People and Place, the journal that it comes out every few months and addresses social and economic issues in Australia. What we've done is drill down right to the local level, because it's the local level at which most Australians vote. And it's the aggregation of those local levels that are very important in determining outcomes in electorates. And what this shows is that there are a lot of electorates where there's great homogeneity in the vote across it, and they're not really going to change. But there are some electorates that are really highly marginal where there is a lot of potential volatility, would take relatively small swings for quite dramatic shifts one way or the other. Using a benchmarked approach such as the location quotient and so on, I think it's a very, very good and simple way to show and identify at the local level for either a primary vote for a political party or the two-party preferred vote after preferences are distributed, in terms of at the local level, are you above or below what's going on nationally, and if so, how much? And that's a good benchmark measure. It's much better than using the actual percentage. The multiple regression analysis showed us that 53% of the primary vote in Labor and its variability across all of Australia's polling booths can be explained by 16 variables from the census. And 54% of the variation of the vote for the coalition parties together can be explained by 10 variables. But when we split the coalition into its component parts, the Liberals and the Nationals, we drop down to about one third variability. And there's lots of funny things going on, particularly in some regional areas and regional big town areas where I think what's happening is Liberals are incurring dramatically into international voting. And we can explain 50% of the variability in the Greens vote. The predictive model, I think, has great potential. It's by no means perfect. We might still regard this in some way as an exploratory sort of analysis still. But it's telling us more than we knew before. And it does enable us to identify large groupings of polling booths that are dominated by particular parties. And then we can show that the variation across those, 84% of it can be explained just by these two dimensions and the variables that line up on those two dimensions. We can explain it by a multicultural younger through to a monocultural older characteristics of populations at local areas. On the one hand, and that's the dominant one, explaining over 50%, about 54% of the variation. And then when we add this other important dimension, we can explain another 29 or so percent on the basis of the degree to which local areas are characterised by advantage and disadvantage and the measures that go with those. And we can see where the parties line up in that socio-political space. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens over time. I find this interesting, that the Liberal Party here, the midpoint, if you like, in terms of the average polling booth that supports the Liberals in terms of dominance of their primary vote, is located in social space somewhere about here. It's almost, it's middle Australia, if you like. And we've got statistical proof of that now. So there's some interesting things.
What you've said that really surprises me is that people with money who are older tend to vote Liberal.
Yep.
People without money but who are younger vote for the ALP.
They're more likely to capture it.
Yeah. Did that really come as a shock?
Not really, but the degree to which the variability can be explained just by a couple of things, I think, is pretty powerful. Okay? I mean, the thing that did come as a bit of a shock to me was, this has moved from about out here at 2001 into there. And it's going to be interesting to see, where, and it's kind of interesting, I think, the Labor one's been drifting in that way.
I understand. Yes. Wouldn't basically whichever party wins the election, one would expect
they've got to capture this
closer to the middle?
Yeah.
So it's not actually a predictive model. It's a post analysis model of what's occurred.
We could run the model to try to predict what would happen next. I've got to update it to the 2006 census. That's not going to be out for the next. So that's going to be important because you get a lot of churn going on in many areas, of particularly of our cities. Populations are churning sort of all the time. But it tells us a little more than we knew before. Yeah, that's the point I'm making. I'll wrap up. I've just sort of said that. The modelling, on the basis of the variables that we used, we were able to accurately predict the outcome in 67% of polling booths, which is not too bad. As I say, I don't think you're ever going to get too much better than that, actually, because the census tells you nothing about people's values. And, if we had that sort of survey data across every polling booth catchment, then we'd be able to do things a lot more accurately and probably start to get up around the 80% or 85% accuracy in prediction. But there is definitely a very clear socio-political space in terms of voter support for political parties and the socio-character and demographic characteristics of local populations across Australia. Labor's very much in this multicultural, younger, disadvantaged quadrant. The Nationals are very much in that monocultural, older, disadvantaged quadrant. The Liberals are more towards the centre, but going towards the centre within that monocultural, older, advantage quadrant. But they're moving to the centre. Well, they have been the last election or two. And the Greens are very, very much multicultural, younger, and in the advantage quadrant, those local areas that produce relatively high support and primary vote for the Greens. A lot more needs to be done on all of this, of course. A hell of a lot more. You may not be using all the right variables from the census. Well, I've got a pretty good spread of them. There might be other things that we would like to include, such as opinion data, attitude data. We just don't have that. We can't build that into these models. It would be lovely if we could. We might want to start to include a whole lot of other variables that relate to what I might call spatial objective variables, such as, is there an influence if people live on the coast as against inland? Is there an influence in terms of the proximity people to have to particular sorts of urban services? and so on. Is remoteness an issue? Is the size of the country town an issue? Those sorts of things. And we can include those sorts of variables in there. So in terms of a final word, what this sort of research can do is to start to provide new takes in terms of enhancing the evidence base that we have in terms of getting understandings of what's going on in terms of relationships between a very important phenomenon, behavioural phenomenon in our democracy, and that's how people vote at federal elections. You can do the same for states, as against what are the characteristics of the local areas at which people where people cast their votes within electorates. And I think this sort of research can provide a lot of useful guidance then for very detailed qualitative research in terms of survey work, electioneering, where to target effort, and those sorts of things. So, thank you.
Excuse me, sir. When this lecture was coming up, I had a look at the website and how you need to be a member to access. Do we have...
No, you don't have to be.
So we don't have to be a member to access this?
No, you can access this website,
Okay, so we don't have to be a member. Can we become a member or we
can't? You can register to do so,
Look, I'm sorry, I wasn't having a go at you, but it seems to me as if one of you're looking at a predictive model. Now, ironically, that's going back and finding out what's happened, that we're doing that.
Yeah.
I think the really interesting thing is the things that don't actually fit into the model. It's not the benchmarking, it's what explains an electorate where suddenly, despite the typical effect, what explains the reason that it's actually changing hands or going against the trend? It's not the trend, it's the stick-outs against the trend.
And trends can change too. We know that from the past.
Yeah.
It's inevitable at some stage there are going to be swings from one party to another. History shows that. It's a matter of when. And where and what. We can show where it's likely to occur. This analysis can show where it's likely to occur, I think, quite a powerful way. This could also show and identify those huge areas across Australia where swings aren't going to matter because the vote for one party is so dominantly entrenched. And we're done with that,
The electoral redistributions in New South Wales and Queensland,
We've got the stuff from the Electoral Commission, and you'll be able to impose the new boundaries over. Okay. It's not on now, but it will be within a week or so.
I was just interested in, you alluded to state electoral, to the state, you hadn't done any modelling when you've done federal modelling.
No, we haven't done it. We first started off with it. Tell me how we got into this. About 10 years ago, when you had the Pauline Hanson One Nation phenomenon in Queensland, and they got, 12 seats or 11 seats or whatever. And there was all this talk about what was behind it. We did an analysis. We actually published that in People and Place as well. We showed that you could explain that phenomenon in terms of very, very specific socioeconomic demographic characteristics. So we actually did that. That's how we got into doing this in the first place. Because it was an interesting phenomenon, and we thought, and we've been toying around for some time of trying to match electoral data.
Except that you've got such a variance now in federal voting patterns and state ones. So you'll have the same... I'll still be a white middle-class male, but I might vote Liberal federally and Labor
state.
We're
talking about federal elections. Yeah.
I'm just trying to work out how you match the...
Well, you probably mightn't, because it may well be that, you've got, in terms of state governments, the parties are appealing to And we know that the people who vote one way at the state don't vote that way federally. I mean, you can tell that in terms of looking at where the vote is locationally. Same people are voting for one party at federal and for a different party at the state. So,
You just have to look at them in different
ways. I wouldn't want to confuse the state with the federal at all.
But you could do a modelling for state. Your parties can just have a look all year.
And, of course, what state governments and federal governments do, they do different things too.
So, therefore, it affects a different person differently.
Please don't try and translate this to state.
Just stemming from that question, is there plans to do like a comparative analysis between state and federal based on that data? You're not planning to do anything like that? And also, is there the ability to map both population density and voting patterns?
Yeah, you could do that.
You can?
Yeah, you could do that with the density. We haven't got that. That might be another variable. Remember, there's a lot of other things that you would be good to include.
I was actually just going to mention, you mentioned the bi-electorate, which is one that I work for, as an example, as a marginal electorate. However, the area that was marginal actually has a very low population
density. That's right, So you need to go in. What we're going to have up on the website within a couple of weeks is we're going through polling booth by polling booth and what, if you get in terms of 0.5% and 1.5% through percent swings, and if they were uniform, then what happens at a polling booth level? You're absolutely right. You need to, if you've got 500 voters at one polling booth and only 80 at another one, and that, well, a swing in one in the heavily populated is going to have a bigger. Of course it is,
Have you got any sense of what the demographic looks like in terms of the people that are swinging voters?
No. If there was a big swing at the next election, we'd be able to identify that a bit, I think, by then looking at where the locations were that the changes are, and then what has the demographic and socioeconomic characteristics of those areas changed or not? Is it due to a change there? Or is it due to these people, I've got seven by plan, and they're going to another? And we do know that over time. Party support waxes and wanes. I mean, that's always been.
Thanks for that very interesting talk. I'm still absorbing all the things you said, but just wanted to ask you about the 2004 election vis-a-vis 2001. I think you've analysed both of those. In at least a couple of cases, changes occurred in seats which were seen to have been affected by developments actually during the campaign.
I'm thinking
particularly of the two Tasmanian seats.
Yes, indeed.
I'm just wondering, in relation to the 2004 election, to what extent did the electoral changes, the seat changes, broadly come under the umbrella of areas and measurable sort of indices that you might regard as within your degree of expectation based on your model? Or were there some which happened and you thought, well, looking at our model, we wouldn't really have anticipated this?
That's very true.
Can I just add another comment?
Yeah.
The reason I ask that is that one thing that struck me about your analysis, if I've understood it correctly, is that a lot of it seems to have been based on the electoral pattern during the period of government since 1996.
Yes, that's
right. And in a sense, one could see quite a lot of broad continuity in the appeal of the governing parties in that period.
Yeah, sure.
For example, certain groups, popular phrase used is Howard Baplis.
Yeah.
Many were won over in 1996,
yes.
And then many have stayed,
yes.
Since that time, like, yes. For example, the seat of Lindsay.
Yes, exactly.
So my other point related to the first one is, if you look at electoral changes within the period of a governing, parties in government who have been predominantly, they've been electorally successful because they've held office since 1996. Yeah. It won't be so easy, in a sense, to look at cases where you might get significant changes in the parameters and the components.
Yeah,
that's
right. Yeah.
If that's not too complicated.
I know exactly what you're asking, and it would be. Well, I would love to go back and model stuff from the mid 80s. And then you've got to match them up with the right census. You're always going to have a little bit of years out in that, and that's life. But we never get perfect stuff in data, so we've got to deal with it perfect data. But you're absolutely right. It would be quite feasible to actually do dynamic modelling and to then identify, across polling booths. And of course, new polling booths get added all the time as well, so that's an issue to deal with. But that can be a thing. It would be great to be able to model, say, over a two-decade period, and then identify your geographic, the places that don't ever change at all, and then those ones that have changed, and in what direction, and by how much, and when, and what were the socioeconomic demographic dynamics going on within that. Now, that's a big, big thing to do, but it's quite possible to do it. And if I can get about $400,000 of research funds, I can do it.
And we'll have you back to speak to you when you've done it. Now, we might close off in thanking Professor Stimson very much for his presentation. I'll just mention three things. That is that the slides, the audio of the presentation today, and the link to the site will be up on the library's website tomorrow. And remember, if you go through to the data, even though we're not a participating member, all of the data is up there. So have a look tomorrow and enjoy trawling through it all. And thank you so much for coming today. And thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
Yes, definitely. Thank you very much.
Very enjoyable.
Yes.
Good.
And
just a question is what you can do with it. You talk about 67% accuracy.
But it won't be working.
Just to sort of simplify. Could you explain that in terms of, there's a limit to what you can explain for structural structure. And the gap is actually Asian
slots. Absolutely.
Yes, your ability to grab that measure by articulating what you
do. And if we get variables and measure that, we get much higher.
Yeah, but measuring agency is the problem.
And you're never going to get those variables in that context.
I mean, you read Paul Kelly's comments about what you say, rather than doing this way. I mean, he's trying to grab that middle.
That's right. That you